Welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's have been happening in Ukraine with a focus on the main story. I am Kirill Lukarenko from Hromadsky Radio in Kyiv, and here is a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week.
Ukraine is ready for visa-free travel. That from the European Council's Donald Tusk.
Dear friend, it has been yet another week which the people of Donbas have endured a lot.
So we presented the new concept on public health, which was adopted by the Cabinet of Ministers, and now we're able to put it into action.
Some of these priceless Ukrainian treasures from the Black Sea have been returned to Ukraine, but others are frozen in the Netherlands.
On Thursday, the EU announced that it's in the final stretch of granting Ukraine and Georgia visa-free travel. In a late-night meeting, member states overcame their internal disagreements. European Council President Donald Tusk said, quote, almost there, visa suspension mechanism dispute over, unquote. It's been a long process. EU announced that it would grant Ukraine visa-free status after the Euromaidan process, if Ukraine met a series of conditions. Things were moving along until about a year ago, when millions of refugees began flooding into Europe and the EU from the Middle East and Africa. The EU scrambled to put up walls. They introduced new rules and Ukraine got caught up in them, despite having fulfilled all of its obligations. Now it seems that the EU found a mechanism which will keep the new legislation in place, yet allow Ukraine and Georgia visa-free travel. The latest decision still has to be ratified by all EU member states and European Parliament, a process which should take a few weeks. You can see 300 Ukrainian cities on Google Street View. This service first appeared in Ukraine in April 2012, as 5 Ukrainian cities became virtually available to the world. The Google Street View team and all traveled around Ukraine with specially equipped vehicles and collected data from other cities and towns. The updated service is now available for anyone who wants a virtual tour of Ukraine. Just go to Google Maps and type in the name of the city you would like to visit. Some Ukrainian parliamentarians want their country to celebrate Christmas on December the 25th. This week they submitted a draft law to parliament that would make that day an official holiday. Ukraine Calling listeners will know that in Ukraine Christmas is celebrated on January the 7th. This is in accordance to the Julian calendar, which most Orthodox churches use. It's only been an official holiday in Ukraine since the collapse of communism in 1991. During the Soviet era, religious holidays were banned. But the state moved to the Georgian calendar that much of the world uses and made New Year's Eve the main winter holiday. So Soviet citizens celebrated on December 31st like the rest of Europe. Now a cross-party coalition wants Ukrainians to celebrate Christmas on the same day as other Europeans do. We'll post a link to the draft law on our website. President Poroshenko visited the Donetsk region this week on December the 5th. He wore fatigues while inspecting the reconstruction of a bridge over the Kazan-Torets River. It was destroyed back in 2014, before Slovyansk was liberated by Ukrainian forces. Poroshenko said he wants to see it operational by the end of the year. He also visited a TV and radio transmitting station that has been restored near Kramatorsk. The tower will now enable Ukrainian media content to reach residents of the area. The following day was Armed Forces of Ukraine Day, so the president visited wounded soldiers in Kyiv's main military hospital, handed out awards to families of fallen soldiers, and participated in an opening ceremony of a special forces training center in Berdychev. BBC journalist David Stern reported from Kyiv that corruption claims are tainting Ukraine's military. He cited Viktor Plahuta, who resigned from his governmental post in the military procurement sector. According to Plahuta, defense contracts are inflated and given to insiders. The OSCE reported that in the Donetsk region there were a similar number of explosions, but fewer ceasefire violations were in the Luhansk region compared to the previous reporting period. Over the past week, one Ukrainian soldier was killed, 16 were wounded. A UN report released this week focused on civilians. It said that between mid-August and mid-November, at least 32 civilians were killed and 132 injured in conflict-related incidents. We'll post a link to the report on our website. Russia's combat losses seem to be starting to appear in demographic statistics. Official Russian records show that the number of dead have soared in Voronezh, Nizhny Novgorod and Krasnoyarsk oblasts, yet there has been no increase in deaths from accidents or alcoholism. Tatiana Kolesova works with the Petersburg Observers Group and shared the information with Radio Svoboda, Radio Liberty. She also mentioned that there are problems with official records in Russia, but the anomalous statistics are striking, suggesting that these may well be combat losses from Ukraine and Syria. Ukraine's government has adopted a new health reform strategy that aims to improve healthcare delivery to the country. Starting in January, Ukrainians will have more freedom in choosing their doctors and move away from the state-directed system that is currently in place. Everyone will be eligible for a new state-funded health insurance, regardless of their place of residence or financial status. This will be particularly helpful for the millions who have been displaced from their homes. People who live with cardiovascular diseases, type 2 diabetes, and asthma will have free access to 25 medications through a national reimbursement program. Family physicians will receive a raise, and hospitals will be given more financial freedom. These and other measures were spearheaded by the acting health minister, Ulana Suprun. Ukraine-calling listeners might remember we reported that the American-born doctor was appointed to the position in July. Despite facing opposition, she has been working at streamlining the bureaucracy of Ukraine's healthcare system and putting measures in place aimed at weeding out corrupt practices which plague the system.
2016 is drawing to a close. This week, we're going to take a look at what has been published in English about Ukraine over the past year or so. Joining us for this conversation is Harvard professor Serhii Plokhi, who holds the Mikhailo Hrushevsky Chair of Ukrainian History and is the director of the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute. He's an award-winning author of 10 books, including The Last Empire, The Gates of Europe, and his latest book, The Man with a Poison Gun, A Cold War Spy Story, has just been published this week and has already been named Book of the Week by the London Times. Professor Plokhi, thank you very much for joining us for this conversation, and congratulations on the publication of your latest book. Let's start with that. The title of the book, The Man with the Poison Gun, this sounds like a spy thriller, but it's actually based on real-life events. Can you tell our listeners what the book is about and why you chose to write about events from back then in 2016?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. And the book, it's a spy thriller, but it's unusual spy thriller in the sense that it's a nonfiction book, which is based on significant research, including research in archives in here in the United States, but also in Ukraine, in the KGB archives. And I'm telling that I'm the author of the book, but when it comes to its title, I have a predecessor or maybe a co-author, and this is Ian Fleming. Certainly the title is modeled on the Man with the Golden Gun, his last James Bond novel. And that novel starts with a very interesting episode where James Bond tries to assassinate his boss using what later became known as the Stashinsky gun, so basically a spray pistol loaded with cyanide. and he fails. He was arrested. He poisons himself in the process. But it's also interesting that before that happens, Bond and his boss, they discuss two killings in Munich of people with strange names, which certainly is a reference to the not just Stashinsky and Stashinsky gun, but also to the killings of Stepan Bandera and Lev Rabbit that were committed by Stashinsky in 1957 and 1959. So with clearly Bandera back in the news, with Stashinsky again being there as well, there was this certainly on my part interest in taking another look at the story of what happened in Munich in 57 and 59. And I was helped in doing that by the opening, partial open of the CIA archives. So we now have access to the CIA investigation into the causes of Stepan Bandera's death, and also by the opening archives, including KGB archives in Ukraine in the last 2 years, that allowed me to get access to the personal file of the person, of the KGB officer who was the handler of Stashinsky at the time of assassinations.
You've mentioned Stashinsky. For our listeners who might not be familiar with this name, could you tell us who was Stashinsky? This is the man with the poison gun, right?
It is the man with the poison gun, so he is the main character of the book indeed. And he was a native of Ukraine who was recruited by the predecessor of KGB at that point in 1950, in the summer of 1950. And when the recruitment was taking place, he was faced with the choice either to start working for KGB or his family and him would be arrested for their really close connection to the underground, to Ukrainian nationalist underground, that at that time in 1950, 5 years after the end of the World War II, was still fighting against the Soviet regime behind the Iron Curtain in Western Ukraine. And once he was recruited, then he was sent eventually to Kyiv for training and then sent to Germany, and his base of operations was East Berlin, but most of his activities were in Munich at that time. Munich was the, after the war, immediately after the war, was the center of the American zone of occupation. And that was also the place where the headquarters of a number of anti-Soviet organizations, Ukrainian, but not only Ukrainian, Baltic, and others were located. So that was the primary target of KGB operations, including assassination, kidnapping, as well as the so-called active measures, so disinformation campaigns as well.
Would it be fair to say that now we know what happened because archives have been opened, and so history is becoming familiar to us? And is that perhaps why you chose to write about this now?
Well, again, not all of the archives are open yet, but certainly those that are opened allow us to better understand what was happening during the Cold War. And also in this book, what I was trying to do, on the one hand, there was a personal story of a youngster who was recruited actually against his will to spy on his family, to spy on his people, and eventually rebels and escapes. And that's how we know the bulk of the story. Now we have archives to corroborate something that that person was telling interrogators. And this is extremely important because when he first told his story about this lone gunman going to Munich with a strange spray pistol that no one knew could exist, the CIA didn't believe him. After 3 weeks of investigation and interrogation, they dumped him on the West Germans because they didn't believe him. Now in the CIA files, we have a report that was prepared as late as 1976, April of 1976, where they still try to figure out whether he was a bona fide defector and the person that he was telling he was, or he was a KGB plant. So again, now with the documents coming from CIA archives, from some German archives, from Polish archives, and finally KGB archives in Ukraine, we can collaborate parts of the story, but we also can understand the broader context in which these assassinations were taking place and what impact they had on the conduct of the two main parties in the Cold War, the Soviet Union and the United States.
Sounds like a fascinating story. I can't wait to read the book. Mine has just arrived, so I'll be reading it over the Christmas holidays. History has been a major battleground in the current conflict that's happening in Ukraine. So people are writing about history based on archives and not just that. What sort of trends have you seen in books that have been published in English about Ukraine over the past year or so?
Well, normally it takes a while to research and write the book. So I don't think the immediate reactions when it comes to the books, the exception would be people who write on current history and mostly political scientists. And in that sense, of course, the most amazing authors are in Britain. We know Andrew Wilson's book on the so-called quote-unquote Ukraine crisis and Richard Sakwa's book, very different takes on what is happening there, but appearing almost immediately. When it comes to history, again, history for historians, it's there are archives involved, libraries, and not just following the news, so it takes longer. But there are some very interesting books appearing now, and one of them was published recently this year in Toronto. And this is the book by Bob Magucci and Johann Petrovsky Stern, Jews and Ukrainians, Millennium of Coexistence, which again, not necessarily deals with the current crisis, but is very interesting in the sense of the formation of the political nation in Ukraine, and now looking, there are two parallel stories, Ukrainians and Jews. They interconnect over millennium, as the title of the book suggests. But again, this is something really very interesting and important. Another book that made a strong impression on me, again, it's interesting that it was published in Toronto. It's George Liber's book titled The Total Wars and the Making of Modern Ukraine, which looks at the Ukrainian history in the context really of global history, from World War I to the end of World War II and immediate years after the end of the war, which puts Ukrainian history in the context of global history, something that we talking in the field for a while, for a long period of time, but this is one of the first books, not just articles, that not just proclaims that as a goal, but tries to do that. And again, I think both books indicate new interesting trends that emerge in writing on Ukraine here in the West in the last, again, 2 or 3 years. But again, the roots of this thinking are, of course, much, much deeper.
You've mentioned books that are written by scholars, experts on Ukraine. A trend that I've noticed, I don't know if you've seen this, is that since the Euromaidan crisis erupted, there's been a real increase in attention to Ukraine, and people who are not experts on Ukraine have been writing about Ukraine with more or less success. I don't know if you would comment on that trend.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, overall, this is a very welcome occurrence that people who write on Ukraine are not necessarily Ukrainians or not necessarily focused exclusively or primarily on Ukraine, because what that means is that it brings new perspectives, provides new framework and formulates new questions. Of course, it's a very, very difficult task to write on the country that you really, in many cases, don't know much about, and that's why we have here really a very, it's a mixed blessing, and we have interventions of a different kind. Some people it would be better for them not to write or not to agree to give interviews. But there are some very, very important additions and really very strong voices and very informed voices. And one of them belongs to the author who didn't write on Ukraine before that, and this is Marcy Shore. And probably those who are interested in Ukraine noticed her recent publication in New Yorker on Serhiy Zhadan. She also publishes in Britain, in US, now in the last year on Ukraine and Maidan and the Revolution of Dignity. And she's working on the book dealing with that subject. So again, overall, the situation is difficult to characterize either positively or negatively, because we have a lot of people who really don't know much about Ukraine. But the fact that there is interest in Ukraine, that there are people who were not doing research on Ukraine now trying to do that, is very positive. And again, Marcy Shore is one of the examples of this positive trends in the field as a whole.
The increased interest in Ukraine is something you've just written about or mentioned. Do you see that there's increased contact between scholars in Ukraine and outside of Ukraine that are perhaps improving the quality of scholarship on Ukraine?
Absolutely. That is indeed what is happening. And it doesn't matter who you are, either you are a journalist researching current crisis, you go there, you meet locals, you have a fixer normally, you have a person who helps you to do that. That provides certainly a perspective on the events that is inside perspective, something that normally people don't have. The same is true when you're a political scientist. You go and you work now with the people in the field, either in the field of political scientists or, for example, sociologists doing pollen data. And this is also true for historians who go to the archives and work together with, have collaborative projects with colleagues in Ukraine. When it comes to history, again, the like everywhere else, there is this increased field for cooperation. My concern is that sometimes you have a situation which reminds one about kind of a colonial type of relationships where data, for example, is harvested in Ukraine, but then the final product is really produced, academic product is produced somewhere outside of Ukraine. So I guess the trick here would be that with this increased traffic to Ukraine, increased interest in Ukraine, that the Ukrainian voices would be heard here as well, and that those would be the voices that would talk on be on par with the commentators here in the West. Because one thing that is obvious is that there is a lot of expertise, there are a lot of talking heads, there are a lot of publications on Ukraine, but mostly what we hear are more or less well-informed voices coming from the West. And we really, very rarely have people and academics in particular, and journalists as well, publishing their materials here in the West and making their voice to be heard. And that's I hope will change in the future. Again, things don't change overnight, but I think this increased context eventually will lead to this reformatting, reimagining the field of Ukrainian studies and commentary on Ukraine here in the West.
You actually anticipated my next question. I was wondering, have you seen any books published by Ukrainians in English that have made it to an international audience? The book that I remember from the Maidan period was Andrei Kurkov's The Maidan Diaries, or the Ukraine Diaries, that became quite well known in the West. But I haven't come across really anything this past year by Ukrainian authors in English. So the voices from Ukraine, I don't see them making it into the Western audience. I don't know if you've seen anything.
Well, exactly. Kurkov, Andruhovich, Zabushko, these are names that are recognizable in the West, but again, not by a general public. more by people who are interested in the subject one way or another. And it's very good that those people are, that there is name recognition, that those voices exist. You have also people from Ukraine, like Volodymyr Kulik, for example, publishing scholarly political science articles and assessment in the West, in the scholarly journals. So that is happening. The question is whether there are people who would have name recognition and would be able to talk if let's say, CNN is interested in the commentary. Again, normally they're not interested. They have a bunch of journalists who can talk on almost everything. But again, there are no really people who can contribute to the debate, not just on the academic level, not just on the level of literature, but on the speak to a broader audience.
So contacts between experts in Ukraine and Western audiences is still an area that needs to be developed. Book distribution is something I also wanted to ask you about. Western scholars like yourself have people who help distribute your books, but there are voices writing in Ukraine that perhaps are not reaching international audiences. Is that something that you see could be improved? Sort of the distribution of work that is produced in Ukraine somehow to make it reachable to international audiences?
Yes, absolutely. That can be improved. As far as I know, for example, the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies in Edmonton and Toronto is now involved in the project of translation Stanislav Kulchitsky's work on the famine of 1932-1933. So, but making the work of one of the leading Ukrainian experts on this subject known to the academic world. So, but again, these are projects that take, in, unfortunately, years, that take a lot of effort, take a lot of resources. So probably we can't expect the immediate return on that kind of investments. But on the other hand, there is no other way around. So the trick is that either people from Ukraine have to write in English and German, or those works have to be translated, and that's the way how the situation can be changed. On the other hand, again, Ukraine is not exactly unique in this case. Look at any other East European country. Look at Romania, or look even at Poland. The situation is not much better there as well. Again, better than in Polish case than in case in Ukraine. But this is a common challenge that the intellectuals, that writers from the region face when they try to enter the debate that is happening in places like London or New York or Toronto or Boston.
Books. How many people are reading books these days? As professors, we assign books to our students, and I guess where I was going with this question is the foundation of our knowledge and our understanding about Ukraine really continues to rest in books. What are the formats that you can think of to transmit, to get books, to get people reading more books, whether there are students or the general audience? Are there perhaps new platforms, new formats that can be beneficial to getting books to audiences?
Well, the book publishing industry is, of course, out there. It is healthy. It of course changes the way how it tries to reach the readers. So, and again, Kindle is one of the examples that, okay, that people less read, or relatively less read, in the traditional format, and more things, people get the information from the screen of their laptop, from the screen of their iPhone, and so on and so forth. So that is changing. But at the end of the day, still, you have to have the text. You have to have this message. You have to have that argument. So that didn't change. And the challenge is how to make whatever you say is not just topical, but interesting for other people to read. When these other people are not your students who have to do that to pass exam or midterm test or something like that. And that's actually the challenge to the entire field of all of us working on Ukrainian topics, not only Ukrainian, how to make what you do interesting not only for yourself, and how to make the argument that you are making important enough for other people to care about that. And that is the ongoing challenge. In my personal opinion, the for example, the British in this sense are doing much, much better. So it's almost a job description of British intellectual to go out there and to write for broader audience as well. When it's a different situation, certainly in Canada or in the United States, and certainly it is different in Ukraine or Eastern Europe, for that matter, as a whole, where the tradition is very much rooted in the value of the academic knowledge per se. And it is I wrote something interesting, I wrote something important, but this is not my task to go out there and to inform people about these things or present that in the way that would generate interest, if not excitement. So it's the task of people out there to discover what a wonderful thing I have written. Again, that has to change.
Well, Professor Plohy, your writing is an example of that. You not only have great ideas and extremely solid research, but you write so well that your books read like novels. And I really look forward to reading The Man with the Poison Gun, and I hope others will be able to enjoy it over the holidays as well.
Oh, that would be wonderful. There was a short review here in the newspaper that I didn't know that it existed. It's New York Post. And it ends with a suggestion that read this book with a martini, shaken, not stirred. So that's.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Films. They are popular and can be expensive to make. Last week, Ukraine Calling reported about Ukrainian films that have recently been made it to the big screen. This week, representatives of Ukraine's film industry met with President Petro Poroshenko. They talked about the law on state support for cinematography. Poroshenko reportedly promised to back the law, saying, quote, "You do not have to convince me that the cinematography requires state support," unquote. The International Women's Club of Kyiv held its 24th annual charity bazaar last weekend. It's something the non-profit organization does on the first Saturday of December to raise funds for people in need. This year they held it in the Olympic Stadium that was built in 2012 for the Eurocup Games. The event is supported by the diplomatic community in Kyiv, since one of its founding members back in 1992 was then Belgian ambassador to Ukraine, Ingeborg Christofasse. This year, 41 embassies organized stalls where they sold goodies from their countries not easily available in Ukraine, like maple syrup from Canada. Proceeds from the bazaar go to help hospitals, children's organizations, the disabled and elderly. Last year, it raised close to 2.5 million hryvnia. This year, they hope to raise more. Crimea hasn't been in the news too much lately, so to keep you thinking about the place, here is a song by the Crimean Tatar rap band Rednecks Chatalov called Tikaran Sabr, which means a little patience.
Бухром, менем эвым бухром, буна унутма айван, чи дышары, бухром, менем эвым бухром, кремяш, сесыны часа на дедам, бухром, менем эвым бухром, буна унутма айван, чи дышары, бухром, менем эвым бухром, кремяш, сесыны часа на дедам.
Anlaşıldı kimin bir yazgın lük kimin xara Yansın bu yaman kırlı para Vaxtım olur yara Menim milletim beçara Ama çok bizde yaramaz Adamlar bunda var Olar seni tutsa bırakmaz Bunu sen bilirsin yok tamam Her şeyi bildik Sıçrak adam Hırım haytsa evine bilirsin Nasıl tekmeye Horantalarını Hırımlarının Bağlarını Ama düşünme Vaxt o gelmez deyip o gelir Ve aşar senin miyini Ayvan malgavur hınzır domuz Bu senin yarana tuz Acayip ahmak bu yerden hak Bu menim dedemin evi Yok ol ki dışarı Gelmez son bu eve Aşarsın kotegi Ve hepsini söyle onda Kim gelse son kaytmaz Bu hırım benim evim bu hırım Bunu unutma ayvan ki dışarı Bu hırım benim evim bu hırım Sesini kes sana dedim Bu hırım benim evim bu hırım Bunu unutma ayvan ki dışarı Bu hırım benim evim bu hırım Sesini kes sana dedim Sabır adamlar sabır Gelir vakti Aktım çay gözünü çıkarırık Haytırda birazdan Mustafa aha yerine Ozunun evine Hırım evine Lenur aha sana bir selam söyleyeyim Pek yakşı adamsın Pek temiz yüreğin Ama tikaran sabır Tikaran sabır Tikaran sabır Tikaran sabır Bu hırım benim evim bu hırım Bunu unutma ayvan ki dışarı Bu hırım benim evim bu hırım Sesini kes sana dedim Bu hırım benim evim bu hırım Bunu unutma ayvan ki dışarı Bu hırım benim evim bu hırım Sesini kes sana dedim
That was Chikaran Sabır A song from Tatar rap band Rednecks Chatalov. An international dispute over Scythian gold from Ukraine will be coming to a head next week. Artifacts from five Ukrainian museums went on international tour to Germany and the Netherlands in early 2014. The exhibit was called Crimea, the Golden Island in the Black Sea. Shortly after the exhibit opened in Amsterdam on February 7, 2014, Crimea was annexed by Russia. When the exhibit closed that August, the Dutch returned only the items on loan from the museum in Kyiv. Items from other four loaning museums are in Crimea, so the Dutch decided to hold on to them. Ukraine has been asking for their return. According to Ukrainian law, all the items are owned by the state and museums are simply custodians. Crimean authorities are also demanding their return. Russia became involved too, laying their claim to the gold. UNESCO has gone on record saying that all heritage monuments of Crimea belong to Ukraine. The matter went to court in Holland. The Amsterdam District Court is due to announce its decision on December the 14th. Ukraine Calling will be following this and other stories. Tune in next week and write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskyradio.org. I'm Kirill Lukarenko for Hromadsky Radio in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.